program and saw how wide and diverse the interests are of people here and their research, so it's really interesting to start it. Now, I'm a scientist, an animal scientist, animal welfare scientist, so the way scientists work, as probably some of you are, is about principles, about data and so forth. So I apologise in advance if this is, if the way I present things is not the way you've seen it, but hopefully we can clear up any misconceptions and the questions afterwards. So what I really want to do is start, because, yeah, I thought being the first, maybe I'll be the person who does the definitions as we see it of what emotions are and put some theory. And then we can ask, well, why do animal emotions matter to us? And I suppose, actually, when I say us, it's probably my perspective from the science side of things. And then also, why should they matter to us? And this is probably an animal welfare perspective. And then we can ask, okay, well, if we want to do something about animal emotions, then how do we recognize them in animals? And also, can animals recognize emotions in other animals? So let's start with a definition. So emotions are obviously subjective states, internal states to the individual, and they're actually difficult to define in words. So even the human psychologists would say that everybody knows what an emotion is until you're asked to define it. So what's the difference between embarrassment and love and embarrassment and depression? They're all kind of subjective states, but they vary in different dimensions, really. And we actually have a lot of theories. A lot of the work used in animal studies have come from the human literature. So we have theories to why they occur and how the body produces the emotional state and expresses emotions. But actually, there's very little out there in the literature on what does it actually feel like. That bit is too difficult, it's too hard, and really you don't find a lot about it. So I guess as a starting definition, this is a definition I like from Plutchik, who's a human psychologist, been around for a while. And he says that basically there are some primary emotions there, anger, anticipation, and you can see them in the kind of second most circle there. These are the basic ones. And he says that emotions are bipolar. So you can contrast rage and, loathing and admiration. It's gone upside down. Ecstasy they are opposite, he's saying. I'm not sure I entirely see how it matches, but you can see the point there. Emotions can be expressed at different intensities, and that I think he's got quite well. So you can go from being mildly annoyed through to being angry, to be absolutely livid and showing rage, and I think that's quite a nice idea. And he also thinks that some of these emotional states are blends of others. So contempt is a bit of annoyance and a bit of boredom. So hopefully we don't get into that state this afternoon too much. So do we actually need emotions? So here's our most famous anti-emotional person in the world, Dr. Spock, and he managed to get by find actually they were highly illogical. Why do any living being need emotional? But this is what the kind of psychologists would counter with. So we do need them. Lazarus, who's one of the kind of major proponents at the moment, says that they tell us about what's going on in the outside environment, and it involves our body, our psychophysiological reactions to that. So it gives you a valence or a meaning to something that you encounter. Oatley's probably more about the social behavior, says there's a motor component response, so that's physiology and behavior to challenges or opportunities, particularly social ones. But the one I suppose that resonates most with me being an animal person is what Plutchik and Jaak Pansep have said, is that they promote behaviors with a high survival value. So if you feel a good emotional state when you're doing some type of behavior, such as eating or giving care to others, you're more likely to repeat that behavior. But if you feel fear or rage or anxiety when you walk up a mountain or stand on a high height or something that makes you scared, we're likely to avoid that, doing that thing again. So you can imagine Dr. Spock, if he didn't have those emotions, he would put himself into risky situations. He wouldn't repeat good situations as much as we do because we have those emotions that kind of reinforce good and bad behavior. And sorry, while I'm just kind of defining all sorts of things, we use emotion fairly glibly, but actually there's kind of three levels in there, really. So technically speaking, an emotional state is a fairly short-term event. It has a focus, and it only lasts for a particular time. So embarrassment, for instance, you accidentally go out with toilet roll on your shoe, then once you've removed it, you're over it, you move on. But things like a mood, this is where people are talking about depression and anxiety. These things go on for a long time, but they're still what we call affective states. They are just longer term. And the final thing, I suppose, is the feeling, which is the conscious experience. And those are seem to be the three aspects to what we group broadly as being emotion. And there are different components of emotions. So, and this is where we start to build up the physiology of it and the kind of bodily response. There are subjective feelings. There are physiological changes like we have here. Sweat, the body readies itself for flight or fight. So there's sweating and there's behavior, running away and so forth. And these are all aspects of emotion. And people might also add expression, facial and vocal, and appraisal, which is the cognitive aspect. And I just put that together because this is how then people start to say how emotion happens. What does the body do? And this was the very first model of emotion, the Cannon-Bard model, back in the 1890s. And the idea was that you saw your stimulus, so this is a big hairy grizzly bear running towards you, and you would have both bodily responses. You would start sweating, but you'd find yourself running away, and you would also feel fear at the same time. But later on, James and Langs, they kind of thought about it differently, and they thought sometimes you're running away before you suddenly think, actually, that's quite frightening, really. So you get the physiology first, they think, before you have the interpretation and the feeling. Now, most people have rejected that, but it is an interesting idea that actually sometimes you, in an extreme situation, you find yourself sweating and running before you actually think, before the feeling comes over you. But I suppose Lazarus and Parkinson have kind of put this together, and this is currently where we are, I think, in that there is some interpretation, but sometimes it's very quick. So you look at that animal and the brain registers that that's a dangerous animal and that you need to do something about it, followed very quickly by running away, sweating and feeling afraid. So that's a kind of model we have at the moment for emotional states. And we'll come back to why we use this model in animals a bit later on. So why should we care about animal emotions? Well, I have to say, as an animal welfare scientist, that's what, I have a complete bias here. And obviously emotional states are integral to animal welfare. So we are looking often in animal welfare at confinement systems, about battery cages, about sows kept in confinement and lab rats kept in smallish cages. And Although often you find that the health of the animal is often pretty good in this, and the productivity, they produce eggs, they grow, they appear kind of productive and healthy, we suspect as animal welfare scientists that the emotional state of the animal or its welfare is not that good. So we suspect that they suffer from boredom, from frustration, and they are not always experiencing positive emotions. So that's obviously why we are interested in emotions, because we need to show that those animals are experiencing negative emotions and they're not experiencing positive emotions as an argument to get people to say, okay, enough's enough, we don't want battery cages, which we have in Europe, they're banned, but they're still used largely in the US. And all of the animals, you know, the test animals that we use in pharmaceutical drugs, you know, can we show that those animals should be allowed to experience positive emotions and there are suffering in order to kind of say, okay, if we need to do this type of work, then let's make life better for animals. So that's my general take on it. That's why, oh, I study it anyway. And the other thing that's happened possibly in the last 10 years probably is that animal welfare science has shifted a bit. So quite rightly, from the beginning of animal welfare science in the 1960s, people have been trying to get rid of tackle the negative issues: animal pain, animal stress, animal aggression. But now we're starting to ask, okay, we can do that. What about positive emotions? So the Farm Animal Welfare Council, which is a government body, said, well, actually, we should be thinking about it in a kind of traffic light system where we should be at least be giving an animal a life worth living. No animal should be subjected to a life not worth living. And actually, we should be promoting a good life for animals, for farm animals. This is my favourite photo of a cow. We once decided that we would see how animals responded to sand, and they loved it. These are adult dairy cows. They would run frisking down and sunbathe in the sand. It wasn't quite so good when it got wet and cold and mucky, but on a sunny day, they did like a good sunbathe. But are we getting ahead of ourselves a bit, really? We say that we want to study animal emotion for good reason, but there are a lot of people, particularly neuroscientists, who would say, hang on a minute, how do we even know that animals experience emotions? So, I mean, we can see that they might look afraid. You see a dog cowering or a cat hissing and fluffed up. They look like they experience emotion. Do we have any idea what their internal state is? That might just be a reflex. So there's been quite a lot of debate on whether emotions occur in animals at all, or to what level, I suppose. And some people take the idea, well, actually, we can't ever know. Animals' experience and emotions are internal and they're subjective, so we really can't get inside their heads. And some people would also say no, because they say if you're looking directly at the brain of the animal, you see in many different types of animals not the same brain structure that a human has. So this is Pansept again, and he's looking across the kind of evolutionary history of animals, perhaps from fish right up through primates, great apes, to humans. And he is saying that the brain of the reptiles only can carry out reflexive behaviour. So you might see flight or fight, but nothing more complicated than that. And then he's saying that mammals, what he's calling lysencephalic mammals, so they have a not particularly comprehensive brain, they have the cortex, which is the kind of reasoning part, but it's not very complex. He's saying that that's enough to give them affective awareness, and in other words, some emotional state or awareness. But further up the tree, you have to go up into the primates, great apes, and humans before you get to the kind of analytical kind of emotional states where the animal has to process information in order to experience emotion as we do. And just to look at this brain idea a bit more, the idea of what they call the triune brain was created in the 1970s, and right down in the brainstem of these are pictures of human brains, but actually lizards have these, all animals have this basic part of the brain, the cerebellum, which controls the basic flight and fight and survival mechanism. So that's why they're saying that kind of reptiles can only have that type of emotion. And then as the brain developed further into the mammalian part, you get the limbic system, which has some emotional function. It also is where we have memories and habits. And this limbic system is involved in the primary emotions that we met earlier before with Plutchik. So fear, happiness, and anger. But the idea here is that the human brain has this very highly convoluted outside layer called the neocortex. And that is where the kind of reasoning and rationale, where the kind of, we think that the ability to have language, to have abstract thought, etc., it all involves the neocortex. And most of the mammals that we deal with on farm do not have this neocortex. So this is why people are saying, well, if there's nothing like that, then animals can't experience these more complex secondary emotions. So I suppose the current thinking is that we are happy to say, even from brain structure, that animals, many mammals and birds, will have at least these are primary emotions. But this is where the state of the art is. A lot of people are looking further into that and saying, okay, really, is that all that there is? Can other parts of the brain do that function, etc., etc.? So, and maybe people here will be pushing those boundaries and tell us about it at this meeting. So if we can agree that animals can experience at least some of the emotional range that animals do, how do we go about assessing emotions in animals? And this is where we kind of get into the experimental part. Well, in some cases, it's apparently not difficult. And Charles Darwin was one of the first to publish in the area of human emotions. And what he noticed was that actually, if you look at the way animals respond to certain stimuli and the way humans respond to certain stimuli, they're not all that different. So here's two creatures that he's assuming are experiencing fear, a cat and a human, and you can see that some of the expression, the behavior, is quite similar. So the kind of the eyes are dilated, the hair's standing on end, the mouth is open, there's kind of a withdrawn posture there, which indicates to him that he could happily say that this animal was experiencing the same emotional state as the human. And here's another example that he had. So here's a person smiling, expressing happiness, and he noticed also that some of the primates also show this kind of mouth open response there. And actually, as humans, it's important for our own survival to be able to recognize emotions. So here's an animal showing an emotional state. I'm sure you can imagine, are we all going to approach that animal? Probably not, no. And here's a nice big hairy animal pawing the ground, lowering its head, again expressing emotional state. It's all sending us a signal, don't approach, this is a dangerous situation. And here's another animal expressing an emotional state. And this is, you know, we feel sadness, we feel pity, we'd probably show caregiving behavior as we would to human infants and so forth. So you can see that we have been probably shaped by evolution to recognize emotional signals in certain contexts because they are going to help our survival and possibly our reproductive success if we go and look after infants and so forth. But It's not always that simple, unfortunately. Sometimes you can misinterpret things, and sometimes the signals are not the same. So in actual fact, Darwin had got this one wrong. So while he saw the nice open mouth and the partly closed eyes, in the baboon, this is a threat display, an open mouth threat display, and not a nice smiling face. And dogs, probably because their long association with humans, are really good at expressing emotions that we can understand, and that you can clearly see what this animal was expressing. Yeah, let me eat that biscuit, please. But what about these animals? We've got lots of those. They are really hard to read. What about these animals? Again, really difficult to read. And apparently, there are more chickens in the world than any other animal. So we need to be able to figure out what they're feeling, what emotional states they are capable of. And this is where, as experimental animal people, we have to use experimental techniques. So we want to look at the behavior and physiological signals that the animal gives us in order to figure out what they're feeling. So this is where we come back to our models, because this is where we get clues about what we can measure. So that means, okay, we could be measuring bodily behavioral responses. We can look at animal behavior and facial expression. We could also be looking at physiological responses. That's another way, obviously, of measuring emotional state. And also, and what is interesting is to look at the interpretation. Are animals capable of this interpretation state? Which might tell us a little bit more about their ability to go beyond the basic emotional states as well. So I'm just going to take you through some of the experimental methodology that's out there for looking at emotional states. And they include behavioral tests, qualitative behavioral analysis, or QBA, observations of behavior, facial expressions. And then I'm going to go on and just tell you about some work that a PhD student who was working with me did on whether animals can look and interpret the emotions of others by looking at the experiments with sheep and goats. So actually, there are quite a lot of studies done and experimental techniques for looking at fear in particular, or fear and anxiety, because it turns out that actually in pharmacology, you need to be able to recognize fear in your animal models if you're trying to develop drugs for anti-anxiety drugs or anti-depression drugs for humans. And they often use lab rodents to do this. So these are very wide, and people are happy to say, well, they have been for a long time, to admit that, well, to be comfortable with the idea that animals feel fear or fear-like states. So this is the classic open field test. Basically, what you do is you put an animal in an open box, and most animals don't like being isolated in a brightly lit area. And you look at what the animal does. Does it vocalize? Does it try to escape? Does it urinate and defecate? Classic signs of fear. You can also use this elevated plus maze, which is a classic pharmacological model. You put the animal into this kind of high raised cross. Two of the arms have shelters or are closed, two of them are open. And you look to see how much the animal spends its time either in the closed or open arms. And this is a novel object test. We often use this more with farm animals. You give the animal some kind of object that it's never seen before and look at its response. And you can see that animals vary in their behavior here. So animals that are quite stressed maybe come from an impoverished kind of housing background will show much more freezing behavior or escape behavior than an animal that is more relaxed with its environment. It will show less of these behaviors. Depressed animals or anxious animals will stick more to the closed arms than they will do to the open arms, and that's how you test their drugs. If you give the animal the anti-anxiety drug, you show it seems to move out more into the slightly more dangerous areas. And you can also, this is what we also use the novel object test for, animals that have had enriched environments, seen lots of different types of objects, interaction with humans, so forth, are less frightened of new things than those that perhaps have been treated badly or are stressed in some other way. Another way of looking at things is to look at the positive behaviours and how animals are motivated to perform these behaviours. So animals actually like to perform things like play, especially young animals. There's a lovely picture of calves frisking in an open field. But animals only show play when things are going well. And so from animal welfare point of view, we can look and see when they stop showing these behaviours. And it turns out that sometimes if they're not on a very good diet or they're not very healthy, then you see less play. And these are cows using a brush. Farmers are more and more giving them access to these brushes. And again, they really like brushing themselves and grooming themselves. But when things are not going well that day, when it's very hot or the vet's been, so it's interesting to see that they indulge themselves less in this kind of positive behavior. And as a behavioral scientist, I'm less clued up on the physiology, but it's an important measure. So what we are looking for in the physiology of the animal is the interplay between the sympathetic nervous system, which gives you the kind of fight or flight response, and the parasympathetic nervous system that restores things back to normal. And you measure these systems by looking at the heart rate and blood pressure of the animal. And during a kind of some of the active emotional states, such as stress and fear, you get a rise in heart rate. And here we have a polar heart rate monitor fitted to a cow. So typically you would normally see these people training for their first marathon, but we stretched it out a bit and put it on a cow. And you can get quite, if you're careful, you can get good heart rate from the animals. Now, heart rate, to be specific, is not always the best way of measuring the physiology, because of course your heart rate can rise if you're really excited. So when you're going to a concert or you're going out for a meal or you're going to do something, you know, you've put yourself on a roller coaster because you really like that sort of thing, your heart rate rises. So it's really difficult when you see a heart rate rise in an animal, is it experiencing this as a positive or as a negative? So sometimes, you know, when you look, give it a novel object and you see a heart rate rise, you think, is that because it's really interested? Oh, look, there's something new there. Or, oh my God, I'm really afraid of it. So now people are looking at what they call heart rate variability. And it's quite technical, but these are all the beats of the heart. And there's a kind of number of milliseconds between each beat. And actually, a healthy person has quite variable heart rate. So there is a lot of the kind of, it moves about a bit. When you're stressed, things become very stable. And that's what they often use in the hospital to pick up underlying health problems, is this heart rate variability. So that's physiology. This is a new method of picking up physiological information without being quite so invasive in some ways. So the idea here is that the sympathetic nervous system, when is readying the animal for fight or flight under a negative situation, it draws the blood in from the edges or the periphery of the animal in towards the heart and lungs to allow you to show that running away or the fight or flight mechanism. And you can actually measure it using thermal imaging in certain cases. It's not easy, but this is a really nice example. So here's a hen viewed through a thermal imager. This is the temperature over here on the side. So you can see that the bare bits of skin on the animal and its comb around its eyes are showing up as hotter colors. Now, what they did to this animal was played it an alarm call or an audio stressor at this time. And if you track it along there and watch what's happening to the comb, you can see that the comb gets colder and colder. The colours start to dip down into here because the blood is being withdrawn away from that area and into the internal organs. And then after a while, it comes back. So it's just a really, what it illustrates is the animal has felt afraid, that it has triggered the heart, the kind of fight or flight response, and the blood is being withdrawn into the animal. And then once it's kind of recognized, oh, there's nothing really that going on, it comes back out. And the thermal imaging is a nice way to pick it up. But going back to behavior, I think Françoise Wemmelsfelde did talk to this meeting some years ago, and she has pioneered a method of looking at the whole animal behavior. As animal behavior scientists, we often look at, so how much activity is there? How much play is there? Do we see a kind of startle jump response? But she says, actually, no, what you should do is look at the animal in its entirety, look at the expressivity of behavior. So what she does is shows short video clips to people and gets them to score them on these scales. So the terms can vary. In fact, she mostly gets people to come up with their own terms. But you get a system like this where you look at a few test videos and you think, oh yes, I can see that animals vary on these scales. From maybe there's some animals that are calm or not calm, tense or not tense, and so forth. And then she gets people to score lots of animals, you know, maybe from different types of farms. She's done kind of intensive pig farms and outdoor pig farms and farms with straw and so forth. And actually what you can find is the way that you see animals expressing behavior can pull different systems apart. So this is just showing, these are different types of farms shown in the different symbols there. But it's just a kind of a nice way of looking at the whole animal. And getting on to the facial expressions, this was done in 2010, 2011. The idea here is that we're really homing in now on the facial expressions of animals. So particularly in lab rodents and various other animals, people are not always that good at detecting pain in animals. So the idea was, okay, let's create a scoring system from animals that are in pain and animals that are not in pain, and then look at what specifically we should look at. So they found that what you can do is focus on particular, what they call facial action units, or parts of the face that really express pain and the most obviously. So we can look at the eyes, we can look at the cheek, we can look at the ear posture, and at the whiskers. So by using quite a lot of experimental work, these people were able to kind of create this chart. So if you were working in a mouse house, you could go in with this chart and check all your animals. If you see animals that are showing some of these more signs of pain, then that's when you think about that you should be doing something about pain relief. And they did it on laboratory animals first, but people have since been decided, okay, let's look for expressions of pain in sheep and various other animals, cats and dogs and so on. And you can see some of the things are the same. There's kind of, the noses are kind of more clenched and tense, and the eyes tend to be a bit more tight. Now I'm going to go on and look and see whether animals are capable of this cognitive evaluation part of it. And this is a little bit intricate here. But the idea is that as humans, the type of emotion we feel comes from how we perceive the situation. And Schroer said, well, actually we have
kind of criteria that we measure the experience against. So we look at the suddenness, the familiarity, the predictability, and so on. And different emotional states match onto different sets of those criteria. So you can, and that different emotional state, that emotional states differ depending on which of the boxes they tick. So you can see that fear and anger, which are reasonably closely related, actually are differentiated on the checks. So you can fear, you feel fear when a thing is sudden, but you don't feel anger when it's sudden. You're more likely to feel anger when something is repeated and so forth. But the idea is that you can differentiate emotional states by the different checks they encounter. And people decided that they would do this with sheep by taking our list here and taking the top three and reproducing them in an experimental setting. So they had some sheep, and as you can see here, it's got a heart rate monitor on it. And what happened was that food would come down this little pipe into a bowl. And there were certain things that were manipulated about this situation. So they could produce suddenness by sometimes a little nice French blue and white screen fell down behind the pipe when the sheep was eating it. And so they could create suddenness by that. They created familiarity by sometimes the sheep had seen that screen before, sometimes it hadn't. And there was a little light here that predicted for some sheep that the screen was about to appear, and that kind of predicted, allowed them to create sudden predictability or non-predictability. And then they looked at physiology and behavior in the way we've described. And actually it did see that sheep were using some of these checks. So when the object fell rapidly, sheep showed this asymmetric ear posture. When the sheep looked at the screen, those that were unfamiliar with the screen looked at it with more forward ear posture. And there was when the object fell rapidly, there was an increase in heart rate. And if it was unfamiliar, they showed this increased heart rate variability. So these different responses suggest that the evaluation is taking place. Not all sheep showed exactly the same response, so they are using some kind of these cognitive checks. And the other thing that's interesting and that people have taken on, including us, is that ear postures are really interesting, especially for sheep, because they can indicate different emotional states in animals. Now this is the final one. Again, we're trying to get at how much cognition is involved in animals' emotional states. And we're again follow on from the human literature. And we know that mood, and now we're talking about kind of depression or long-term states, affect your decision-making. So anxious people pay more attention to threatening stimuli. They have negative expectations of the world. So, then if something new happens, they're more likely to expect that it's going to be a bad thing than a happy person would. And they generally have a glass half empty attitude to life. And the opposite biases occur in happy people. And this is what we call cognitive bias, or particularly judgment bias. Now this is, and we've taken this through, or people have been taking this through to look at this in animals. Now this is a bit of a complicated situation, but bear with me and hopefully we can explain what's going on, how you run this sort of test in animals. So basically, you start off by training your animal to do two things. So it knows when it hears a high tone. If it responds to that by pressing a bar or coming forward, it will get a good thing, food. If it hears a low tone, it must learn that it shouldn't respond by pressing the bar, because then it will get a negative thing. So it's kind of got approach and avoid there, a positive and a negative. And then because we're interested in welfare, we put the rats into half of them went into a good enriched housing, some of them went to a bad housing where unpredictable things happened, cage tilting, cage floor, bed wetting and so forth. And then what happened was that they tested not only the originals, the positive and the negative, but these intermediate states. Now that's really crucial, because what we're asking is the animal in this negative state where it's expecting bad things to happen? And what you're expecting, if the animal is experiencing that negative mood state, is it will start to expect these intermediates to be negative as well. And that's in fact what they did find. So when you look at what the groups, so that we've got the green group coming from the enriched housing and the red from the bad housing, when they are responding, their response to the negative is pretty much the same. But you can even see that the group from the good housing are even hyper responsive and really and looking for the positive. They're expecting that to be a positive. But really what happens in the intermediate is that you can see that the animals that we've given the bad housing to have become pessimistic. They are less convinced that those intermediates are going to turn out to be good than the animals that have come from the enriched housing. So our conclusion in that is that the underlying mood state of the animal is affecting its decision making, its judgment. Which is interesting because it tells us that they are processing a lot of information before they make a decision, but also what you do to them, how that you house them, can affect their emotional state and through that their cognitive decision making. Okay, so that's most of the background to it. This is just a few things that we have done. So we are quite interested to see whether animals can interpret emotional states in others. And this, and we started off with sheep because they are quite a good animal to work with, and because other people have done work with sheep. So we know that sheep are able to discriminate the faces of 20 of other sheep, and that they can remember the identity of other sheep for at least 2 years. And then when they did an experiment where they morphed faces using a morphing software, they could discriminate between them. So very subtly, I'm finding it difficult to tell those sheep apart, but clearly they can. And then they can also, in one study, show that they could discriminate the faces of calm and stressed individuals. And that's what we decided to take on a bit further. So this was the PhD of Lucille Belgar, who was working between us and a group in France. And she took photos of individual sheep taken in three situations. So we took them in a neutral situation where they were just ruminating in the home pen. And the social isolation, which they really don't like, so this is kind of in a negative situation. And in an aggressive encounter where they were competing for food. So we took these photos of these animals. And then we asked whether sheep can discriminate between them. So we gave each sheep a pair of photos from the same animal. So this is the same animal in two different situations. That's another animal experiencing two things. And then we had four different groups. So in one of those groups, the animal was rewarded with food for approaching the neutral one. Others were, another set were rewarded for approaching the aggressive photo, and so on. So there's four different groups who each got food for approaching a particular type of photo. And this is how it happened in real life. So basically you have a start box. The animal has sees these two different faces on two video screens, and it's rewarded for going round that photo and receiving a food reward. So if this one had been, she's got to learn, okay, that's the face I'm looking for, I go round there and I get food. And you use a criteria in these types of psychological experiments to say that the animal has learned by the number, a certain number, it's got to reach a criteria of getting 80% correct choices. And what we did was see how long it took them to learn that. And then we said, okay, well, it mightn't be that they are learning about the emotional state that's appearing, they might actually be using something just particular about that photo, about the angle of the head or so forth. So to try to make it clearer whether they were using emotions or not, we use the different, use this kind of transfer thing phase where they had to then go on and how successful are you at picking up the emotional state on another set of animals. And here we have it again. So this is what we found, is that actually some sheep don't work very well in this situation, so we ended up with 16 only. But actually, 16 out of 16 animals were able to learn over a number of trials to tell the two different faces apart. So they could reliably go for one face or the other to get their food reward. Then when we transferred over to this other set of animals, 11 out of 16 could do that. So 69% of animals could make that transfer. But what was interesting was it was mostly the animals who had to learn the aggressive face that couldn't make the transfer, which is really interesting. You do wonder what it is, and we don't actually know why. Maybe aggression is something that they don't pay a lot of attention to, so the next face was difficult, or they identified the particular individual and couldn't make the transfer. But that's quite of an interesting finding. The other thing that was interesting that we found was that they'd learnt the negative image quicker. So these were the number of sessions to learn the thing, discrimination. Sorry, and because she's a French student, it's written in French. But you can see that these are the neutral faces and these are the negative faces, and they were quicker to learn, fewer trials to learn the negative. So that's interesting in its own right. What is it about these negative images? Maybe they pay more attention to negative images. We also went on to do some more of this work in goats. So again, we presented positive, neutral, and negative images to goats. And this time we weren't asking them to discriminate, we were just looking at their facial expression. And basically this is how we did it. So the animals, they were kept in a group, they came through the door and they presented with a pen, and here in the back is a TV screen where we show the images. And this is what we got. So animals looked spent more of their time looking at the negative images and the neutral images than they do at the positive images. And this is because we were looking at ears forward, the kind of attention face on a goat. So there are different reactions between the positive and negative and neutral are the same. You don't look so much at positive, which is quite interesting. So our conclusion here was that sheep seem to be able to discriminate between different emotional states, so they can see that they can interpret the emotions on other sheep's faces apparently. And response to positive states are different, so they seem to be less interested in positive states in their pen mates. And it may be that you need, it's kind of built in, it's an intrinsic thing to the animal to take more notice of things that are going wrong. So, oh dear, if she's feeling stressed or upset or aggressive, then maybe I should do something. Maybe I should pay some attention to her because it might help me. So just to conclude overall, the study of emotional states in farm animals is an important area of research. There's a wide range and a building range of ways of looking at that. And the studies have shown that animals are capable of a wide range of emotional experience. And the more work we do, the more we learn about how much they can do. But, I mean, this is an ongoing area. When I first started lecturing on an MSc in behavior and welfare, I had about 3 slides on emotion. Now it's more like 40. So it's just because people are working in this area. And thank you very much for your attention.